Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, what a beautiful morning in Portland, Oregon. The sun is shining. It looks like it's going to be a great day, about 80 degrees. And if you're just getting up with that first morning cup of coffee, you're listening to Investing Simplified, where we answer your questions on the air. We have a financial advisor, myself, and I want to welcome Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck.
Morning, Carl. And Kevin Stege with the Baker Colson CPA Firm.
Good morning, gentlemen.
The guy that keeps you paying your taxes.
That's true.
Absolutely.
Or paying less taxes.
I like that better. I like that better. Less is more.
Paying the just the right amount of taxes.
I like that. I like that. I think somewhere in the in previous court hearings, there was a law established that we are not required to pay any more than the legal amount we have to pay.
That's right.
That's correct, and we have a legal right to assert that, you know, our position as to what that amount is. However,
and that would go along with litigate and prosper.
It does.
Yes, absolutely. Well, listen, we're here on Saturday morning to answer your questions. We're going to have fun, so I hope you have a fun morning. And we're going to talk about a lot of things today. But again, if you want to call us and you want to ask a question, give us a call. The number's 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. We have a couple lines open. So if you want to give us a call, call in early so you can get that question answered. And remember, the question you ask, nobody out there in radio land, the 20,000 people that might be listening, nobody's going to know who you are. So you don't have to use your real name. You can use a fake name and just ask a question. So and have some fun with it. Well, listen, I'm going to talk about the stock market because a lot of stuff going on, a lot of reports about unemployment, a lot of reports about the economy, and a lot of baloney going on, a lot of things that people are saying about the economy and the market that if you have a little common sense, you take a look at your own portfolio and you take a look at what the market's really done, I think you might come up with a little bit of different story. And I like to kind of run the numbers, and this is how I kind of give the stock report, and I'm going to give it as of Friday. And wow, I just looked at my report here. I think I printed the right one. Yes, I did. Okay. This says the close of Friday. I looked at that. Oh, man, I got the wrong date on there, but I have the right date. I'm okay. It's Saturday morning, you know? Saturday morning, what do you get?
The coffee has not kicked in yet.
The coffee's not kicked in. The caffeine's not taken.
If it was the wrong date, nobody would know, Chuck.
Well, that's true. unfortunately, yeah, you're right. Well, this is as of the close of yesterday's stock market, and I took this off Yahoo. The Dow Jones closed at 15,425.51. It was down 72.81 for the day and about 0.5%. But where does the Dow stand? And here's the thing I want to make sure everybody understands about the recovery. Everybody's talking about the recovery from the bottom, not from the top. Now, unless you were one out of 2 million that may have timed the market and got out at the right time and got out before the big dip, you probably took the big dip. And if you took the big dip, what you really got to look at is what did you have before the big dip and where are you at since that time? Because remember, a big dip in your portfolio exponentially affects the rate of return of future dollars. And if that's complicated, call me and I'll explain that to you. But anyway, as of 10/9/07, the Dow stood at 14,164.53 before the decline. So since that market collapse and the recovery, the Dow Jones currently is up 8.9%. Now, that's in 5 years and 10 months. That's an average of 1.54% a year. Now the Dow Jones, up until 2000, the 80 previous years, averaged almost 10%. So I wouldn't exactly call that a rosy recovery. The S&P 500 is even worse, because the S&P over that period of time averaged over 10%. But the S&P closed at 1691.42. It was down 6.06, and it was down 36 basis points for the week. For the day. Where do we stand on the S&P at that top period before the down market? Well, we're up a whopping 8.10% for 5 years and 10 months. That works out to an average of 1.39% per year. I'm going to say this real clearly. If you don't have a strategy right now for part of your portfolio to protect you for the upcoming down market, and you can go back and look at history charts all you want, but in good times, and I'm saying good times, which would be prior to 2000, the market usually went up 3-4 years, then took a down market. 3-4 years, down market. But since the turn of the century, what we've had is a down market with 4 to 5 years up and then a horrendous sharp down. That next sharp down is coming. We've had the 5 years up. I'm telling you, I'm not going to predict the day, but I'm going to tell you, somewhere between now and 2015, I think we're going to have a market correction, and I think that correction is going to be dramatic. Well, and I think it's going to be equivalent to 2008.
Yeah. Well, it's not just protecting yourself for this coming potential downturn, but it's positioning yourself for future investing. In other words, if you're in a more of a cash situation, you could be in a very good position for future investments.
Well, as I've said previous on the show, you know, cash is king. If you have cash and you've preserved your principal in a down market and you've avoided the down decline, then you could take advantage of some things. The people who really came out in this last decline were the people who were in cash and didn't have their market go way down. And not necessarily cash, it could have been in bonds, but they didn't go way down, and then they lived to fight another day, and they had all their principal to fight with. And that's the key, retaining your principal. And I think in the new economy that we're in, and I think anybody that looks at what we're doing in this country, pumping $85 billion a month into the economy, has to realize we're in a new economy where our government's decided we can bail everybody out. And Carl, I thought you asked one of the best questions on our interview with Harry Dent. When you asked Harry Dent, should they have just let those companies fold and be done with it? And he came out with a resounding absolutely, because if we had done that as a country, if Bush and Obama both had just let those companies go, hey, right now we'd be in a roaring economy. And that's what people out there have got to understand. You know, government doesn't basically pull you out of it, but they can sure as heck train wreck you in it.
Well, you know what sort of sparked that question was, you know, we talk about capitalism being a good system, and we talk about the market, and we know that people who are willing to take big risks sometimes get big rewards, but also some people who are willing to make big risks get big hits sometimes. And that's the way it's supposed to work with companies. That's one of the reasons people establish corporations, is so that they're, you know, they bet the farm on the corporation, but they hopefully will have preserved their own personal assets. But in any event, if things go wrong and they bet wrong on their corporation or their company, then the company goes out of business. I mean, that's the nature of the process. And to segregate out specific industries just because they are going to cause some harm to others. You know, I mean, I think maybe that's a question of whether we should allow them to get to where they were. But nonetheless, you know, if it's good for, you know, Ma and Pa Corporation, why not, you know, some of those other big companies.
You know, Carl, you're exactly right. One of the things I'm going to talk about in my upcoming book is about the stock market. Is it a level playing field for us, the average investor, to invest in the market? And one of the problems we got is so many big corporations that are publicly traded now treat themselves like the government. And whether or not their company made profit or their stock went up, they still bonus out all their executives. Look at the banks. I mean, the banks are notorious for this. They lose money, their stock goes down, everybody gets a bonus. How's that work in the real world?
That's right. And being too big to fail means that you have no skin in the game. And when you do not have checks and balances, everybody needs checks and balances. I mean, it doesn't matter who you are, and history has shown that in, you know, I mean, just look back when there hasn't been checks and balances. And that's why our present government setup system is very good. We have checks and balances, three different branches of government that keep each other in check. So
only if they work effectively. They're not. That's the problem. I mean, you're right. We do have checks and balances, but one, you know, we need more. I believe, and I'm not one for regulation because I kind of hate regulation. But sometimes you got to have it to keep the bad guys from doing what they do. And one of the problems we have right now, I feel, on publicly traded stock is those companies like the banks can run amok because they're too big to fail. And when you're too big to fail, what is your risk? You have no risk. Like you said, Kevin, there's no skin in the game. They know if they train wreck, the government's going to write them another big check. How lame is that?
Well, my comment is, who says they're too big to fail? I don't buy it. I don't buy the whole story. I don't think that it's like Chicken Little. I don't think the sky's falling. I don't think it would have fallen. It would have been bad, but I don't think it would have been any worse than it really was.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think what they should have did is take those big banks, broke them up, gave them to a lot of well-ran regional banks. I mean, we have a lot of really well-ran local regional banks here in Portland particularly that could have used the additional market and customers, and they're doing a great job. They're spending their money properly. They're not going into big debt, and they're running their banks properly. And so I think they could have just broke those things up all over the country and divided them up and made some of the smaller regional banks bigger and stronger.
I know one particular local bank that did not jump into all of that mortgage mess back 5, 6, 7 years ago because they saw what was happening and they weren't willing to compete with what was going on everywhere else, and they came through just fine.
Yeah, I think a lot of the smaller banks, local regional banks, and some, Carl, that you and I are very familiar with, have done extremely well during this time. And of course, the credit unions are basically unscathed as well. Even though I have a little problem with credit unions being nonprofit when their profits are pretty high. And I think they get a distinct tax advantage, and they have a great advantage against the banks that that one of these days the banks are going to scream for help. And one of the places I think the government's going to look at is the credit union situation.
That sounds like the NFL being a nonprofit endeavor also. That's nonprofit.
Yeah.
The NFL is a nonprofit entity.
Well,
very nice.
Speaking about the NFL and college football, I don't know if you saw, the NCAA has decided to back totally out of taking any money off of jerseys.
Well, they're trying to hedge against this other lawsuit that's coming against them. So, that's what they're trying to do. So. Yeah.
That's called CYA, covering your assets.
Yeah.
Yep, you bet. Well, listen, the other thing, including about the markets, not really having the kind of rosy recovery we want. I mean, in good economic times, unemployment's around 5, real 5, not a fake 5. Right now, real unemployment is way higher than the 7.5 or 7.6 or 7.7, whatever they keep jugging around. And it always disturbs me when I'm going to point it out because I buy their paper, and I don't know how much longer I'm going to buy it, but I buy the Columbian. And I got to tell you, the article they did on unemployment, I read that thing, and the more I read it, the more confused I was, and I have a pretty good grasp on it. But, I mean, if you want to make something out of nothing, just give it to a newspaper writer who can who has a political point of view he wants to expound, and he can make a hole in the ground look like Mount Everest. I mean, that's about. I mean, they're trying to make a rosy picture out of a crappy unemployment. The fact that so many people have left the workforce, that's why our numbers are holding. And the real unemployment, if you calculated unemployment the way we did in the Bill Clinton administration, right now it'd be about 14.5%. And drive around this city and look at how many office spaces are open. That to me is a scary part, because 80% of new jobs are created by small business owners. And when you drive around this town and you look at small businesses and you look at small little office buildings or strip malls, and you look at them being, you know, the question is, are they half full or half empty about the glass? Well, you don't even have to ask that anymore, because it's about a quarter. It's about a quarter full and about three quarters empty. And so it's not even a half and half thing. And until we address jobs in this country, I mean real jobs, promoting business and the growth of business in this economy, it's not going to take off. And that's what we got to do. And we got to somehow reduce the national debt. We got to somehow shut the faucet off and shut it down. If we don't, I hate to say this, but my kids, my grandkids, my great-grandkids will be paying for it. And unfortunately, that's a long line of generation. Well, listen, the other thing is I want to report on that oil closed at 104.18. Last week it was 106.72. And gold continues going down. Gold was 13.1170 last time reported, and it closed at 12.8510. The amazing thing, Kevin, is Carl and I attended a business meeting Wednesday, and a real estate broker talked about the fact that 30-year rate was about 4%. Well, I look at the 10-year bond rate, and the 10-year bond rate actually went down this week. It was 2.602 and went down to 2.58. So I'm kind of wondering there, because if the 10-year rate's coming back down, but yet the 30-year bond rate's going out, I don't know. I think that's the thing we got to all look at, because the scary thing to me is to see interest rates start going up towards double-digit returns.
Yeah, that's
then
true.
We got problems.
Yeah, and just to educate our listeners, the reason we talk about the 10-year bond rate in conjunction with 30-year mortgages is because a 30-year mortgage has a typical lifespan of around 10 years before it's either refinanced, paid off, what have you. So it's a they're actually similar investments, and they tend to follow each other fairly closely. So that's why we look at that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The average person stays in a home actually about 7 years. So That would mean that the average 30-year rate is probably paid off, you know, around 10 years for sure.
You know, I think we're beginning to see, too, in the real estate market, one of those things that is, to me, just a little bit disturbing. When you hear of the home going on the market listed, and then you have a line of people actually offering more than the list price to begin with, and then sort of a bidding war, it makes you think back in terms of 2005, 2006, and you wonder how is that working, and how fast should the market values go up, and you know, there, I think that there's a great deal of speculation. It's kind of like the ammunition shortage, and you know, I mean, it really is. It just doesn't suggest a good thing.
Yeah, you know, the other thing about real estate, the thing that people are missing, and I have a client who's in kind of a real pickle on a large value home, and what everybody's talking about in the real estate market is that $250,000 to $500,000 home. Those are the ones that are moving right now. The really big money, the people that have a lot of money that buy those million-dollar homes, they're not doing a thing. They're not touching anything, because they're looking out long-term, and they're saying, hey, this recovery may not be a recovery yet. And they're not seeing the real recovery, and particularly in the higher homes. And until you start seeing the higher homes start moving, when you start seeing the bidding on the higher homes, then you know the smart money is knowing what's going on. Right now, it's the amateurs playing against the pros. And the pros are sitting on the sideline licking their chops, saying, go ahead and jump in, baby. Go ahead. Because when this thing falls and we end up buying that home you just bought for 20% less than you paid for it because you can't make the payments, they're coming in with the cash. And there is a ton of cash on the sidelines, and there's a reason for it, because of uncertainty. Uncertainty is the biggest concern of the markets. And until the government makes definite hard choices that they got to make in taxation, definite hard choices they're going to make in job creation, this economy is not going to take off like it needs to. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with Carl's comments. And you're listening to Investing Simplified. If you want to ask a question, give us a call, 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
This is our Spotlight on Business, where we bring you an expert on the latest in the financial world, from residential real estate to commercial property or to property tax relief. Buying or selling a business? The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation, or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management, on the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepson, and it's time for Carl's comments.
We got a caller on the line here too, Carl, for actually a question for you. We got a call from Walter. Walter, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Good morning, Walter.
Good morning, gentlemen. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yeah.
Perfectly.
Yep.
My question is with regard to a couple of the items that that Carl mentioned last week on the checklist of things to do when that the successor trustee needs to do when the person passes away. Did I understand correctly that one thing is to set up a tax ID number for the estate?
Well, yes. If your trustor has passed away, yes. Because then you really need, it's become its own separate entity at that point, or taxable entity, and it needs a tax ID number to be administered. Because the second thing would be that, depending on the, if there is income, you would ordinarily have to file what's called a fiduciary income tax return at the end of the year. So you needed a number to base that on.
So then the taxes would be for the filed for the estate using that newly set up tax ID number?
Right. Although, I mean, usually what happens is that the assets, or the income at least, gets distributed out to the beneficiaries, and they usually end up paying the tax on it. But and in fact, you'd generally want that because the tax rates on the trust are higher than the tax rates on the individual as a general rule.
Oh, okay. And then I think you mentioned set up accounts for the estate, financial accounts for the estate, for the purpose of the estate. Is that
Well, yes, you would use that. It makes sense because at some point in time, a trustee has to account to the beneficiaries for what's happened with the trust assets. And it's important for that trustee to completely segregate his own affairs from the affairs of the trust. And we found that it makes a lot of sense if you're going to be paying some of the expenses of the trust, which generally you do as a trustee, to establish your own bank account. And that might mean that you transfer some of the assets or liquidate some of the assets and put the money in this account. But then that should be your checking account, your estate checking account, and you would use that to pay expenses of the estate and only that to pay expenses of the estate. That way, you have a very good tracking method to establish your accounting for the, you know, to be able to show the beneficiaries that you use the money wisely.
You see, for example, my mother has a revocable living trust, and she has set up her checking account is titled to the revocable living trust. When she passes away, does the successor trustee is the successor trustee able to write checks on that?
Yes.
On that account.
Yes. That's one of the reasons we would do that is because that leaves a seamless transition to the successor trustee. But what you would want to do would be, I think, would still get a new EIN for if mom passes away, because that way it'll be taxable to the estate. Although it usually gets taxable to the beneficiaries. More often than not, in a revocable living trust, what happens is that upon the death of the trustor, the trustee has the duty, in most cases, to go about gathering all the assets together, paying all the bills, and then distributing the assets. And usually that happens within a relatively short time, depending on what those assets are, to the beneficiaries. Now, obviously, that isn't always the way it works because there may be, you know, like real estate assets that are difficult to deal with or any number of things. But as a general rule, that's kind of what happens. Or if there's a situation where the trust establishes like new trusts or establishing sub-trusts for, you know, beneficiaries that mom didn't want to give all the money to all at one time or any of those kinds of things, well, then the trustee has continuing duties and then you're going to have to keep the new EIN number for the trust until those duties are finished.
Okay, and that new EIN is actually for the estate as opposed to the trust.
Well, it would
right?
be the trust. You would call it the trust, just depending on, it would still be the trust.
Okay.
Yeah.
Understood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for clearing that up. I appreciate that.
You bet.
Great show,
thanks
gentlemen.
For calling.
Just to add a little snippet on that topic, there is when a person dies and they have a living trust, the trust, as you said, Carl, becomes irrevocable and a tax return is going to probably be required. And a trust has its own filing requirements. If they have probate assets also, then you also have an estate income tax return that needs to be filed. So now you have a trust return and an estate return. But most people don't know that there's an election that you can fold the trust in with the estate. And it's a no-brainer election to do. Number one, it simplifies your filings down to one return. And an estate always has more favorable rules than the trust. It's a pretty straightforward election, and it's a no-brainer to do. So anyway, that's why you need to hire your tax professional to make sure you're getting all those things done right.
Absolutely, that's one of the number one things I put on my checklist for the new trustee or the new personal representative is, if they don't have a relationship with a CPA, go get one. And because it's very important. And there are some lawyers who actually do tax returns, and sometimes they're tax lawyers and they're very competent at it. But my experience has been that I don't think most lawyers do spend their time most of the time doing tax returns. And whereas CPAs do hundreds and thousands of tax returns, and if they're familiar with estates and trusts and things like that, I have never felt that it would be economical enough for me to do tax returns to even think about doing it. And quite frankly, most lawyers, I think, don't have the kind of software that the CPA does because it's fairly expensive, and you don't want to do that if you're not going to be doing lots of tax returns. So anyway, I think it's a good idea to go to the CPA and have them do what they do best. But that's just me. Anyway, Carl's comments today, I want to talk about something that we all know about, but a lot of people have a lot of misunderstandings about, and that is the durable power of attorney. The durable power of attorney is essentially a document that allows someone else to manage your financial affairs. That person that is going to manage those is sometimes called the attorney in fact. That alone gives rise to a very big bunch of confusion. So to separate that out, I'm going to separate the two parties. The person who's giving the power is called the principal. The person who's getting the power is called the agent. So that way it makes it a little bit easier to understand, because I think that power of attorney term tends to get really confused. So let's start with that. The agent is going to be able to handle the financial affairs of the principal, and they're going to be able to bind them to contracts and use their money for the best interests of the principal and until or unless it becomes revoked. And upon the death of the agent or of the principal, the power of attorney dies with them. However, this is where the term durable comes in. A power of attorney is durable because it survives incapacity. If a principal becomes financially incapable, then in the old days, under common law, a power of attorney was no longer valid. But under current law, it is valid, and it lasts through the, at least until death, if that's if the person becomes incapable or incapacitated during life. And a lot of these are a very useful tool. They make a big difference if, you know, mom gets really sick or something and you've got to go and handle her bills or, you know, transfer property or sell property or whatever it might be to take care of mom. However, they do have some problems that are kind of born of, you know, some trends in society that are not altogether, you know, exciting. But first of all, let's talk about a durable power of attorney has to be in writing. Ironically, most people think that it has to be notarized or witnessed. It does not. However, if you consider the fact that if you're going to do anything with real estate, generally what you're going to have to do is to have a notarized document to record in the deed records, it makes good sense to have a notarized power of attorney. But to be absolutely legal, it doesn't actually have to be. But being the case that it we always do notaries just because they might get recorded to transfer property, real property. So that's one of the things. You can limit the time of a power of attorney. In other words, you can say this power of attorney is good from today for 6 months. Or you can limit the powers of a power of attorney so that it's not just a general power of attorney, but it's one that is a power of attorney that just deals with the sale of real property or just deals with the management of the bank account. That's what we tend to call a special power of attorney. Most are not. Most people want a general power of attorney that allows them to do all of their financial affairs. Here's one of the biggest areas that we have problems, and that is there is no legal requirement that a bank or any other financial institution accept the power of attorney. And so it's very common that if mom does a power of attorney or dad does a power of attorney and then 5 years down the road gets really ill, needs somebody to help them, and son goes down to the bank and says, hey, here's my power of attorney. They're going to say, no, we're not going to do that. And even though the ironic thing is, and the ironic thing is that they shouldn't worry about it, because the law in Oregon basically says that if a bank or a financial institution or anybody else accepts the power of attorney and does whatever the agent asks them to do in good faith, without having actual knowledge that there has been a revocation or that there's anything wrong, even if there is something wrong, even if they're using it for nefarious purposes, the bank's not liable. Even with that in the law, they won't do it because they're so afraid of financial elder abuse. And so here's my, you know, that's one of the things that is really, really a problem, because the power of attorney is the most commonly used tool for the financial elder abuser. And it, you know, it gives rise to people stealing mom and dad's money. You know, Candy the caregiver drags, you know, Uncle Remus down to get his power of attorney, and they go to the bank and, you know, she runs off with a new Corvette. It's not that uncommon. So those kinds of things are problematic. That's why the banks and the financial institutions are paranoid about doing it. So the other thing that's often difficult when you have a legitimate power of attorney and you want them to make decisions for you and you give them a whole list of the decisions, the authority that they have, but it doesn't always explain, in fact, most of the time it doesn't explain how those decisions are to be made. And in other words, doesn't give them any reference point. And they just have to refer back to what, you know, mom or dad was going to do. So it's sometimes good if you have a certain kind of philosophy or you have certain things that you want done and certain things you don't want to be done, to define those in a power of attorney so that the agent knows if you become incapacitated kind of how to go about doing it. That's a difficult thing, and so you can kind of set some examples and things. But as a practical matter, it's one of those things that would be very helpful to some, you know, agents. Or attorney in fact, if you prefer that term. The law does impose duties on a power of attorney, the agent, and a number of them, the most important of which is the duty of loyalty, which is to always act in solely in the best interest of the agent or the principal. In other words, you can't use it for yourself. You can't, you know, you're not supposed to be borrowing money. You know, you're not supposed to be taking stuff out. You're not supposed to be, you know, fixing up your own house with the money. It's supposed to be solely for the benefit of the principal. And you have a duty to exercise reasonable care. In other words, if you, you know, if you skip going to Chuck's office and you go to the, you know,
Uncle Bex.
What's the guy's name? Madoff. And he says, oh, I got these pork belly futures for you. Then that's not a good thing. That's not acting with reasonable care. So you have those two duties, and those can impose personal liability if you go beyond those duties. There are other duties too, but those are the primary ones that are in concern. So with all of those thoughts, it's very important to select a power of attorney or an agent very carefully. I recommend that you don't wait. Do it now because if you wait until you're incapacitated, the person has a hard time getting anybody to accept them. And secondly, with respect to those things that you really, really want done for sure, that is taking care of your bills, when you do the power of attorney, walk down to the bank and the other financial institutions that you expect might be needed if you become incapacitated and go to those institutions and say, hi, this is my agent. This is my attorney, in fact. Here's a copy of my power of attorney. I want them set up on my accounts so that they are the power of attorney on my accounts. Not that they're a joint owner. They're just going to have power of attorney over these accounts. And then that way you've just covered the bet. And if you then later become incapacitated, then they're already good to go. And they're not going to question that power of attorney because they've already eyeballed you and they've eyeballed the agent and they've said, oh, okay, that works for me. So that's the suggestion I have, and that's what I know about powers of attorney.
That's a lot to know.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
Sometimes it comes in handy.
There'll be a quiz at the end of the show.
Yeah, be a quiz. Yeah, yeah. Right.
Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with Kevin Stege, the tax investigator. You're listening to Investing Simplified on a beautiful Saturday morning here in Portland, Oregon. We'll be right back.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503 513-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
And we are back with Investing Simplified. Thanks for sticking through the break and hanging with us here. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the same things we were talking about earlier, Chuck. But before we get to some of that, I think one, you know, we're working on a joint project, all three of us are, and I've been doing a fair amount of research and reading and putting stuff together. And I can't believe how much misinformation from seemingly experts there is on the internet in regards to, you know, in what I'm looking at here, tax aspects and, you know, some planning ideas and things like that. And it's just, wow, don't go to Google to get your tax answers. That's my tip for the day.
Yeah, remember, your information cannot be found on the internet necessarily. It is accurate. That's
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah. And for example, I mean, even just one particular thing here, I was reading an article on avoiding audit triggers and reading this seemingly knowledgeable fellow that was trying to indicate how to avoid an audit and completely looking at one tiny aspect of this subject has missed the big picture. One of his points was to beware of taking excess travel and entertainment deductions. Well, on the surface, that sounds good. But if you think about it, if you're doing travel and entertainment for business and you've got the documentation, why wouldn't you take that? Are you scared of an audit even though you've got the documentation and you can?
If you did it, you did it.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you didn't do it, then, yeah, you probably should be a little wary, but you shouldn't be doing that anyway. So, anyway, it's things like that just kind of...
Good point.
Yeah. So, on a different topic, several weeks back, we had the Supreme Court make their ruling on the Defense of Marriage Act and saying that that can't be upheld and so that gay couples can have the same filing statuses as a married filing joint. And regarding tax purposes, I guess the only thing to say regarding that is welcome to the marriage penalty. And gay couples will now have the enjoyment, if that's a word, of actually some of the tax things that they have just recently passed has reinstated the marriage penalty. They kind of had cleaned it up several years back where the marriage the married filing joint bracket was half of the single or double the single bracket, so on and so forth. But for example, with Obamacare, the 0.9% Medicare tax on wages and self-employment income, that is for single people. That tax kicks in for single people making over $200,000 or married couples making $250,000. Well, clearly there's a marriage penalty there. The 3.8% Medicare surtax on net investment income that kicks in with folks. I believe it's I got my brackets mixed up. But that kicks in also for single is $200,000, married $250,000, and then of course the itemized deduction limitations that they just reinstituted for 2013 and the reduction in your personal exemptions, that again is also people, it's like $200 for single and $250 for married. And so those things do hurt.
Well, you know, Kevin, isn't also, though, the fact that Marriage Act is from the state level, but does the federal government, my understanding is the federal government still does not recognize them for estate planning purposes.
Well, I think it was actually I think it was an estate case that this was based on. It was a gay couple that had one partner passed away and the other did not get the marital deduction. And so they ruled that this was unfair to that couple. And so that's what this whole ruling was about. So it actually, my understanding is that, you know, they do get the marital deduction now on estate cases. So,
well, okay, I mean, that would make sense that they would.
Yeah, for federal purposes.
Yeah, for federal.
Well,
what about for state?
I think, that's a good question because I don't know whether that is answered yet, tell you the truth.
Yeah.
But the question, because then they left open the issue of you know, states' rights on things with other cases. So
yeah.
I'm not sure what they're going to do with that.
Yeah, there's still some shaking out to do, I think, on that. Well, back to our previous topic, Chuck. The latest housing reports have come out, and the prices for single-family homes have climbed 87% in 87% of U.S. cities in the second quarter. Now, last year at this time, it was 75% of the regions had gains, and this time it's 87%, 142 out of 163 metropolitan areas. I just think it's an interesting thing here when values are increasing. Home buyers are encouraged. Getting my topics.
I'm not
here.
The only one that didn't have my caffeine kicking this morning.
Exactly. I've had too much caffeine. That's the problem.
Yeah.
But anyway, the median price for single family homes is at $203,000. So you were indicating, you know, $250,000 to $500,000 homes. I think the median price around the U.S. is $200,000, which is up about 12%. It's going to be interesting to see how the rising interest rates, along with rising house costs, are going to mesh together. I just don't think the house costs are going to continue to rise the second half of the year like they have earlier this year. So
yeah, I think the real key is the homes from, you know, even 100 to 500 are selling. But it's the upper-end homes. And, you know, really when you look at the Northwest, we were relatively did not get hit anywhere near as hard as the rest of the country. We've been very, very fortunate. But where we did get hit and what people missed the boat on, we got hit on the higher-level homes. Those really took a beating and continue to be down. And, well, I'll tell you, there's a real tough situation to get people to be able to get financing. You know, the government's saying they're wanting to do the recovery and they want to get them, but you almost have to walk on water to get a $750 or $1 million loan.
Mm-hmm.
You better, or anything over that, you better have the cash sitting somewhere where you can pay that loan off immediately.
That's right. And in a separate report, the Mortgage Bankers Association said that the number of delinquent U.S. mortgages, those that are 90 days or more behind or in foreclosure, plunged to the lowest level in 5 years. So I'm curious to find out somewhere how many homes that have been foreclosed on are not on the market. In other words, we have a limited amount of homes. We have, I believe there's 2 million homes in inventory in the U.S. for sale right now that are listed. Are there others that the banks are holding back so that they're not flooding the market, so that they're getting more for the sale of these foreclosed homes? I'd be interested to see.
Well, my understanding, there's about 12 million that they haven't foreclosed on that they could foreclose on. And the reason they're not foreclosing on them is because the banks would have to pay the back property taxes, because municipalities don't have any collection ability. If you haven't made your house payments, and all they can do is put a lien against the title of the property. But once the bank takes over the property, then the bank has to pay back those back taxes, because then the municipality has somebody to come back after. But they can't go after the individual homeowner on that.
Mm-hmm.
So
they could try, but that's why they're underwater on their mortgage in the first place.
Well,
probably,
all they can do is add a lien against the deed.
That's right.
Yeah. And so the bank's not going to call those, because the bank's got to pony up the, just imagine if your property tax was $4,000 a year and you hadn't paid taxes for 5 years and your house is underwater anyway, and you're not making the mortgage payments to the bank. Well, the bank has to make a choice. We're going to either call that house and have nobody living in it, and open up on the books and pay the county $20,000 to kick this guy out, hey, the banks are not stupid. They're saying, hey, if we leave that house vacant, what's going to happen to all the copper wiring and all the stuff in the house? It's all going to get stolen. So they say, well, let's leave the guy there. Maybe he'll turn his life around. Maybe he'll come back and we'll be able to refinance the loan. Let's not foreclose on this guy. And there's supposedly about 12 million of those throughout the country, which is a ton of them.
Yeah, I think the ones that they have foreclosed on, I think that's one of the selection aspects of which house to foreclose, has to do with the value and what's owed on it and what taxes are owed and what the market is. And they want to see if they can get their loan paid back by taking the house. If they have that kind of house that they can, you know, make a deal. That's why it's so difficult. There are a lot of, used to be what we had called a deed in lieu of foreclosure, which basically said if you can't pay your mortgage, you go to the lender and you say, how about I deed it back to you? And you'd think that would be a simple thing. But it's not, because in today's world, it's darn hard to get the bank to take it back. They have to make that assessment that they're going to turn around and be able to get out of it and get their loan paid. And in fact, I think I've only had one bank in our office that I know of in the last year or two that allowed us to do a deed in lieu. And that's, I think, pretty rare.
Well, I know, you know, in a situation that I'm familiar with a client that, in a situation, a very high-valued home and property, and then had trouble with zoning, and they couldn't do what they thought they could do. And, you know, it's the old story. It happens all the time. But this particular person is looking at foreclosing on the house and doing a short sale.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to cost them $50,000 to do the short sale because that brings the value back down from the loan to the value so that the bank will do it. Because the banks now, like Carl, you and I know a client, and I think Kevin knows the client too, who lost a foreclosure in Vegas and ended up paying a lot of income tax on that house. Even though they didn't get the income, they just foreclosed on the loan and it came back as income.
Yeah, because it wasn't their primary residence. Was, yeah, they got hooked on it being an ancillary property.
Well, maybe you guys have seen this latest wrangling that's going on with the Federal Housing Administration and some of the cities. For example, the city of Richmond in California is looking at potentially using eminent domain rules to force lenders and investors to sell underwater loans, and then the city would refinance those loans into a more affordable loan and basically making the banks and the investors take it in the shorts. Forcing them to do it is the thing, and then the city would refinance those loans, and then they would be holding healthy mortgages that people could afford. The problem with that is the federal housing finance agency said if a city does that, they will have Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae cease any lending whatsoever in that city. So a major, that's like dropping a bomb to squash an anthill. So
wow. Well, you know, we're running to the end here pretty soon. So I just kind of want to do a couple of announcements here that I think is kind of important. We're going to be having a special guest on the, I believe, the 24th. Is that right? Today's the 10th, so 17th, 24th. On the 24th, we're going to have one of the co-editors of the Survive and Prosper newsletter, free newsletter that you can get for free. You can link to that off my website at www.pfgwm.com. And Harry Dent's co-editor, Rodney Johnson, is going to join Carl and I. Kevin's going to be gone that week, but is going to join Carl and I for the first half hour of the show. So I'm really looking forward to that because we had a very lively one on the 13th of July with Harry Dent. And incidentally, I have got my website set up so that you can go on my website if you miss one of our shows and you want to hear it, or if you called in and you want to hear yourself ask a question on the show, you can do that too. I've got the shows taped on my website, and you can go there and plug in and listen to past shows. I also have my interview on there with Lars Larson, and I have our interview on our show with Harry Dent. And so those can be taken right off the website. Kevin, how does somebody get a hold of you if they want to get a hold of you?
We're at bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569.
Okay, and on the web?
BakerColson.com.
Okay, and Carl?
WarrenAllen.com at 503-255-8795. Conveniently located on 122nd Avenue, one block north of Gleason.
I like that. Well, we're conveniently located on 99th and Stark, or 99th and Washington Street in southeast Portland, right across from the Mall 205 of what's there. And also, we're right off the 205, very easy to find. And we're on the web at pfgwm.com. And I would really recommend that you check out any of our websites. I know that, Kevin, I know you have a newsletter that you send out. And Carl, I'm assuming you guys...
I don't really send out newsletters. I tend to... We do a website, and the newsletters that I send out, I tend to send out an annual letter to all of my estate planning clients that basically says, hi, how are you? Is there anything that's changed? It's sort of a reminder letter to keep current with their estate planning. And if there's some really significant legal development that might change their mind about something, I'll try to include that in those letters.
Well, I also have a newsletter that you can sign up for. We have a weekly newsletter that you can sign up for that's free. And we also send out a monthly newsletter, which is kind of an update of the month and kind of an update on the market. And you can get those right off the website. You can also sign up for a Survive and Prosper newsletter from Harry Dent on that site as well. And so we have various information there. I'd also recommend that if you're concerned about retirement or estate planning, I have some videos there about those subjects in the Client's Corner. Good information. Well, we're going to sign off. We'll be back next Saturday morning. I hope the weather's as beautiful as it is today. It's supposed to be nice all week. Go out there and enjoy the week, and we'll be back next week with Investing Simplified.
We do Investing Simplified.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
Let's face it, the rules of retirement have changed. What we were told to do just a few years ago now seems like a pipe dream. Hi, this is Michael Burnett for Chuck Price, owner of Price Financial Group Wealth Management. You know the drill. Be a loyal employee. You'll get a pension. Your home will be worth 10 to 20 times what you paid for it when you retire. So how's that working for you? Call Chuck Price right now. He's located right here in Portland. Featured expert on Investing Simplified on AM 970. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or close to retiring, and he focuses on protection of principal and tax strategies to minimize your taxes. Call right now and get Chuck's retirement report. It's packed full of information on generating more income during retirement, how to leave more to your heirs, and so much more. 503-253-3000. Chuck Price, Price Financial Group Wealth Management, on the web at pfgwm.com.
I'm Ben Affleck. Many actors have played the part of U.S. servicemen in the movies, but for veterans like James Crosby, their service and their sacrifice are real. And too often when they come home, their struggle continues. For over 60 years, Paralyzed Veterans of America has been fighting to help our injured veterans get the benefits they need and have earned.
Paralyzed Veterans of America was there for me when I came home.
Join me in supporting our paralyzed veterans. Visit pva.org.
A public service of Paralyzed Veterans of America. When Americans volunteer to serve their country promises to take care of them when they come home. For a paralyzed veteran, day-to-day living is a major challenge. Paralyzed Veterans of America works to make sure our veterans get all the benefits they were promised from the country they proudly served. A spinal cord injury is an injury for life.
And at Paralyzed Veterans, we are their partners for life.
To help America's veterans, visit pva.org.